Today is Women's Wednesday on Mind Talk, and I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Women's Wednesday, we focus on all things for and about women. Today's guest, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Lori Jean Glass. Lori Jean is the executive director of Five Sisters Ranch. She's a relationship coach. She's the founder and CEO of Crazy Train, which I will ask her to tell you about in a second. She, in fact, is quite busy helping people to recover from really painful relationships. Lori Jean Glass, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Pamela.
Tell us about Crazy Train. That's an interesting descriptor. What is Crazy Train?
Well, Crazy Train is kind of the words I use to describe one of those relationships that makes you feel like everything's out of control. So
okay.
It's somebody that has a lot of anxiety or somebody with a tremendous amount of depression or just a lot of chaos around you as a result of usually attachment wounds, some kind of unresolved trauma, mood disorders, all those kinds of things that end up being a part of one's primary relationships.
All right, let's talk about some of the things that you just identified. You use the words attachment wounds. What does that mean?
Well, you know, clinicians oftentimes will refer to attachment styles or attachment disorder. And what they're talking about with their clients and what people need to understand about themselves is we all have a very unique attachment style that's usually mirrored after our child's attachment. And when you look at how you are attaching relationally, you can have a really good understanding of why you're drawn to who you're with, about how you deal with conflict, if your expectations are realistic in relationships, your attitude towards sex, your ability to know and ask for what you want and need in relationships. I mean, so much of what you do has to do with how you attach to others.
Well, give us a sample of specific relational styles, what attachment styles rather.
Sure.
What do they look
like? I'll give you a great example.
Perfect.
I'll give you my own example.
Okay.
So when I was a young girl, my father was a basketball coach. I'm originally from West Virginia. That's why I have the double name. And we were on the banks of the Potomac River, and he was out in a canoe with a few of his players and another coach. And the canoe tipped over, and when they pulled him out of the water, he was he died.
Oh,
he drowned that day. And I was very young, under 5 years of age, and that was the imprint of what I call an abandonment button. And my attachment style, being born into a very secure environment, changed drastically because I lost my father, and I also lost my mother that day because she turned to alcohol very quickly and ended up dying when I was a teenager from alcohol. So my attachment style when I got older, very bright, very capable, yet I could not have somebody leave me. So my attachment style was very anxious. So I would do what my two adult young boys call stage 5 Klingon. You know, now just keep in mind, I've done a tremendous amount of work and I don't attach like that anymore, but wasn't aware of it. So that's a great example of somebody that had unresolved trauma that was attaching relationally very anxiously and not being fully aware. So that's a very good example of attachment. We also have the avoidant attachment style, which is that person that grows up in so much chaos that there's no room for them to breathe. So they have a tendency, this is your child growing up with a narcissistic parent or an addict as a parent that's got just a bunch of craziness going around, and there's nowhere for them to breathe. So when they get into relationship, they feel engulfed, and then they push away.
Gotcha. And talk about, we hear the word narcissistic thrown around. It's actually become part of a relatively daily vocabulary for many of us. What exactly does narcissistic mean?
Well, I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and you'll get to know me quickly. I'm not gonna define that, because what I think that's part of the problem, and that's why it's being used so much. It's when I was using it in the context of an anxious relationship style, it's that person that is so inner focused on self that they're not taking care of what's around them, right? That's one way of describing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people are so mislabeled, and so we are over-diagnosing and under-treating people in every arena, our medical field, our healthcare field, our psychology field. I mean, we are so over-assessing and under-treating, in my opinion, in our society.
That's interesting because, you know, relatively recently there's a whole new series of diagnostic categories and codes, and there is literally a code and a category for pretty much everything. Actually, everything.
Are you talking about the DSM-5?
The DSM-5, yes. And the ICD-10, mm-hmm. All kinds of codes.
Mm-hmm. And I get what's driving that. It's our insurance companies, you know, and it's also, you know, we need to be able to, I don't want anyone to misinterpret what I'm saying. I believe wholeheartedly in diagnosing. I just think that we diagnose so much that we don't always treat. We just keep lying, you know, putting more and more labels on someone. I'm like you introduced me, as the executive director at Five Sisters Ranch. And what we do there, Pamela, is we have young and middle-aged and older women come in for a 12-day intensive, and we work with them on their relationship with self and others. And 8 out of 10 women that walk through our front doors when we sit down to do their initial assessment have themselves labeled with 5 or more labels all the time. Well, Lori Jean, I have anxiety disorder, and I'm also a love addict, and I'm also a codependent, and I'm also, I think I'm borderline personality disorder. That's what I've been told, and I suffer from depression. And I sit there and I take a deep breath and I just say, well, okay, and what is your name? Right?
Right. Right.
What is your name? It's like what is a human being that doesn't understand fully what all of that means? What do they do with that? I mean, you want to know why Brené Brown is so popular. It's they go right into their shame spiral.
Absolutely.
They fall right back down and they can't really get up, because when they start Googling what all of that means, they don't stand a chance inside of their heart and their mind, and their feet get frozen and they don't know what to do. So their chance of having a healthy alignment is really, you know, slim.
Well, you know, with all of those labels, and I agree with you. I mean, I believe that there is value in diagnosing to the extent that it gives you a way to think about and potentially treat the individual. But when folks come in with not only the sort of the popular labels as well as the diagnostic labels, and they attach them all to themselves, that's pretty burdensome. There really isn't any place to breathe. There's no place really to go with all of that. I mean, I'm thinking about that woman you just described with all of these labels. My goodness, what does she do with that?
That's right. So what we do is we take all the labels off of her. We become disinterested in that. What we go in and we look at who she is and why she's doing what she's doing, because she needs to have a buy-in. She needs to really understand. Like doing something like a relational timeline can illuminate a most common relational pattern that is showing up in all of those 5 different diagnoses. Like somebody with borderline personality disorder is usually somebody that fluctuates between intense depression and intense anxiety.
Right.
Right?
And that's going to show up.
They're going down 2 different lanes. And oftentimes you peel back and you see that they were a result of a very tumultuous divorce. So they had to adapt to 2 different ways of being in order to be. So to simply call somebody like that borderline, it's like you got to teach them to find a lane and empower themselves to go down their own lane as an adult.
And certainly with borderline, I mean, I know that's just an example you gave, but borderline is one of those diagnoses that people still are largely unclear about. And I think that there's, you know, clinicians do a lot of different things with that particular diagnosis. You have said that relationships, love, and addiction in today's world go hand in hand. What do you mean by that? Why is that true?
Well, because our technology is set up to create an addictive style of being relational, right? So when you have an attachment wound and then you go onto something like Match.com and you're searching and looking and hunting for someone, or even Tinder, that's going to take you into fifth gear. That's going to produce a lot of anxiety with trying to find something. So you just keep looking and looking and looking, and you keep going back to it and back to it and back to it, staying up late at night. I know women, I've coached women that have been on multiple dating sites that cannot turn their computer off at night.
That's pretty scary. You know, mm-hmm. I hear people talk about Tinder. Can you say, I'm aware of Match.com, but I have to confess, I'm not as aware of Tinder. What is Tinder? How is it different from Match or some of the other sites that are perhaps, I was going to say more popular, but maybe, you know, I'm just sort of behind the curve on that one a little bit.
Well, I'm happy to talk about that. I do a lot of talks on falling in love through technology. And what I know about Tinder and some of those is that what they do is they create an avenue for hookups, really. That's really kind of what Tinder has become now. Some people use it as a way just to meet people, but Tinder is an app where you first look at somebody. You don't read all about who they are, where they're from, what their likes, what their dislikes, anything like that. It's really about, do I like that person? Swipe one way. Do I not like them? Swipe another way. Very, very disheartening.
Well, and it certainly doesn't speak at all to the individual, but don't all of the dating sites require a picture?
Yes, but some of them are more content oriented,
okay,
as opposed to just look at me oriented.
Okay.
So there's a difference there. There's a difference there. You know, I mean, we live in a world now where we either learn to live healthier with technology or not, right? Because it's not going anywhere. Like, we're not going to change it. Yet our culture is so pornified now.
That's
with
true.
Our fashion, with our music, with so much that you want to be able to know the relationship that you're having with technology. I'll give you a great example. I think you'll really like this. When I talk about falling in love through technology, I give an example of how people enter relationship. And when I do this for the younger generation, like 30 and younger, they're all like, they get it. I mean, the first thing they do when they're looking to ignite a relationship is they go on what I call the hunt. And that's when they start looking at their Instagram, Tinder. They don't go to the sophisticated dating websites. It takes too long and it costs money. But there's all these other avenues of searching and hunting. And then right when they find someone, they start flirting, and then they exchange a little bit of information and they start texting one another. And then the texting becomes sexting very quickly.
Indeed.
And then after that, they decide whether or not they're going to meet. And then it becomes social. So think about that. It goes from the hunt to flirting to sexting, and then it becomes social. We used to socialize to meet people first.
And now we used to take a minute or two.
Pardon me?
We used to take a minute or two before we actually decided to have sex with folks.
Exactly, exactly. So it's just a different way of being, but it's a way of being for the younger generation because, I mean, they're all getting, you know, their iPads in kindergarten now.
That's true. And
you know,
it's concerning, but we digress. For the folks who... Well, let me just stay with technology and relationships for a moment, because there are some people who may have mobility issues and find that the ability to meet people, get to know people online is actually wonderful and sort of takes them out of a very lonely place. What's your thought about that?
Well, I think that's fine. Again, I'm a big believer in individualizing and taking a look at one's unique storyline. Like, I don't know if you've ever taken that StrengthsFinders test, but the biggest strength that I have to offer people is the ability to for individualization. And, you know, to ask me a question like that, it would really just mean, who are we talking about, right? For some people, it absolutely can be a good thing. And it's a great tool to have as long as they're very clear on what the purpose is for them. And they don't have any kind of old wounding where that's going to prohibit them from actually going out and meeting people, right?
Absolutely. So let's talk about a woman who, and do you work exclusively with women or do you work with both sexes?
I work with both sexes. I do a lot of, my favorite person to work with is a couple with high conflict.
Why is that?
Probably because I'm Sagittarius in German. I don't know.
Okay. That's a reason.
I'm kidding. I just really love watching people have breakthroughs. And when you look at a couple that's having a lot of conflict, typically what's happening is that they're at that turning point where something has to break, and they don't know how to turn it back inward and self-correct and be relational together. So they make it about something else or make it about each other. And I love watching the light bulb go out when they're able to dissipate that conflict and have intimacy as opposed to intensity in their relationship. It's so beautiful to witness.
Couples in which there's been infidelity, do you have a thought about approaching that kind of work?
Absolutely. I think that when you look at infidelity, you have to look at its origin, right? So if somebody is, why is it going on? So the first thing I would do is look at see if there's an attachment disorder there. Like, is somebody really compromised with how they're attaching? Because oftentimes people that cheat are so used to that secretive behavior because that's the environment that they grew up in. So the minute they feel like they're going to be abandoned or something's not going right, they'll go and they'll get something and they'll be very secretive. I've worked with women that have had an affair and women that binge eat in the middle of the night, and they get there from the same place.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And then there's some people that cheat just for the sake of cheating, and they don't really care, and that's a whole different lane.
Yeah,
that's much more complicated to be able to resolve the conflict than somebody that is doing it and they don't really understand why they're doing it, but they feel like they need to do it, or have really low self-esteem and find themselves in that arena for whatever reason.
So it sounds like what's important, at least at the outset for that kind of work, is to understand the role that particular behavior plays in the individual or the couple's lives.
Absolutely. I think that's always the starting point for any kind of conflict, is to understand why it is that you're doing what you're doing. Because many people don't really know. They don't really know. They're moving so fast. And they're just, I like referring to what I call a healthy alignment. I talk about that, you know, a lot with people. And it's where you take a look at how somebody thinks and how somebody feels and what's somebody doing in relationship. And oftentimes they're not lined up.
Exactly.
You know, like people with attachment wounds that are very anxious, they feel immediately and they do something right away and then they think about it later. And people with avoidant type of attachment wounds will automatically think and then they'll do, and then they maybe the feelings will come later. And then people that are ambivalent will just think and feel and think and feel and think and feel and think and feel and think and feel. They don't do a whole lot because they live in a question mark.
Yeah. That's an interesting way of putting it. They do live in a question mark. You mm-hmm. When you begin to encourage your clients to examine their own relationship patterns, when we come back from the break, I'm wondering if you can tell us what exactly that would look like Folks, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Lori Jean Glass, the Executive Director and of Clinical Operations at Five Sisters Branch, and the founder and CEO of Crazy Train, a relational recovery company. We'll be right back. Lori Jean, is there a particular way that you guide people into evaluating their relationship patterns?
Yes. Usually what I do and what we do at Five Sisters Ranch is we have them do a relational timeline. And then it's a process where it's quite extensive because we have a long list of characteristics that we have them color code the timeline with when they're finished. It's about a 3-day process.
Interesting. That sounds quite intensive.
It is. That's why we call it a 12-day intensive. But the cool thing is, the cool thing is they get what I call a piece of paper that's worth gold. It's like it would take years of therapy to be able to get there, to really see that there is really a common relational pattern that's causing 70 to 90% of the conflict in the relationships that you're engaged in, not just with a significant other, but also with parenting and coworkers. And, you know, it's usually a survival pattern that you've learned to use so that you don't have to manage and tolerate the uncomfortable feelings.
You know, as I'm just sort of imagining someone going through this intensive look at their own relational patterns, I'm thinking of the person for whom, I mean, they'd rather watch cement dry than do that kind of digging. It's perhaps anxiety provoking, overwhelming, or they're afraid. What do you say to those folks who are really reluctant to dig within themselves in that way?
Oh, I can tell you, definitely. My sister refers to me as and I try to take this as a compliment, as somebody who's helps people, is, you know, disarm, right? She uses that word a lot, disarm, what it is that they're holding on to. Like, that's their choice, Pamela. Do you want to stay stuck in the cement, or do you want to live differently? Like what, when you close your eyes and you sit down and you really think about it, do you want to dig with support and help and guidance and be able to resolve this, or do you want to stay in the cement?
And for
like
the
people, really, when it gets down to it,
yeah,
at the end of the day, you're going to always go to that crossroads, because you're going to keep running into the same thing over and over again. It's kind of like when you meet somebody and they keep marrying the same person. Have you ever met anybody like that?
A couple.
Yeah. So that's what's happening, right? So it's like anything else. How bad do you want it? Like I watch all these people, and I'm fit, and I believe in working out and taking care of myself. And I look around sometimes at the people that will go to CrossFit and the people that will go to exercise class, and they'll go to so many great lengths to make themselves look good on the outside, and yet they're not willing to go through the tough weightlifting inside. So I just break it down for them. Like, you can either do it now, or you can let it keep popping up for you.
For those folks who, and they may not even come to you initially, for those people who don't believe there's another way to be, are afraid that there might not be another way to be, what is a way that you talk to them?
Well, it's very hope-driven. It's I talk to them with a lot of kindness. I try to get them to see that there is a different way. You know, again, it depends on, I get curious with them. Like, what is it that's keeping you from seeing that there is a light over there? Like, you have to look at, oftentimes people that have been sexually abused or people that don't trust, you know, can you trust me first? Can you trust whoever's trying to invite you to change first? What do you trust? Like, we've got to get real curious with people like that and then meet them where they're at and then walk with them over to a place where they're ready to start changing. Or let them know that it's available when they really feel like they're ready. You know, without the willingness, you can't change.
Well, that's true. And you can't make somebody else choose to walk a path that you want to create for them, because that just doesn't work.
Mm-mm.
You've said, and I'm quoting you now, as much as we hate to admit it, our society has become one big pool of anxiety and depression that stems from the addictions. That's a pretty harsh statement, a big statement, you would say a true statement.
Well, yeah. I mean, so many people are so filled and riddled with anxiety and depression. I mean, look around. Look at the drug companies. Look at the, you know, I'm very careful when I talk about medication. I'm a believer in it as long as the diagnosis is accurate and the medication they're taking is accurate. But we have so many people that have created a dependency on a false positive that are really struggling because they're so uncomfortable with themselves relationally. They're so anxious about our economy and about, you know, what's going on for them financially and what's going on with their kids that are being exposed to so many things that they were never exposed to at such an early age. The you know, just Facebook, Instagram, I mean, all of it. I mean, it's not, that statement isn't to be a Debbie Downer. It's just like, let's get real about what's going on is what that statement's about.
So it really is.
I mean, every place I go, every group I've been involved with, every table that I've had the privilege of being asked to sit down and break bread with, there are people when they start getting down to talk about what's really going on for them that are really struggling. Look at our schools. I mean, do you not see that?
You know, the what's going on with the schools, and we could have, you know, a 10-hour conversation just about that, is pretty frightening in a lot of ways. And in today's world, it seems like, and I don't know that I can say it's more than or less than or the same, but the idea that you've got some sort of addiction, which may or may not be identified as addiction, is almost a given, particularly for our young people, whether it's being on the internet, and, you know, how many times have we seen young kids and adults walking across the street in traffic with their heads buried in their phones, and they're texting or they're reading an email, or these games that the kids are playing that have all kinds of levels of stuff involved with them. And I don't think that every parent, every child, every person who's actively engaged in these games and all the stuff that's available through the internet actually see themselves as being addicted. You know, people think about addictions as, you know, drugs, alcohol, maybe sex, and that's kind of it. I think your point is that addictions show up in lots of different arenas.
That's right. And a lot of times people don't see that. And you know, again, we can take that word away if it makes somebody uncomfortable, right? The question I like to ask people is, so what are you doing over and over again that's not working for you, that you can't stop doing it? If you can't stop shopping and your credit cards are way out of whack, what do you call that?
Exactly.
I mean, what do you call that? So if addiction feels like it's shaming, because, you know, we're so, I'm a big believer in being loving and offering compassion. I'm very compassionate. And I'm also a realist, right? And I think that so many of us have a tendency to be so careful with people that we don't invite them to take a look at what's really going on. I mean, I always get, it gets down to fantasy versus reality. Is what you're doing and saying fantasy or reality? Like if you're saying that it's not an addiction, but yet you can't stop it, is that because you want to tell yourself that it's not so you can stay into denial and have it be a fantasy? Or is it you want to look at the reality and do something to change it? You know, process addictions aren't something that people have to engage in their whole life. It's, I mean, people have this idea that if you're an addict, you're screwed for life.
Yeah.
And that's just not true. I mean, I haven't had a drink in almost 19 years. And my mom is an alcoholic, so that was a choice that I made around not drinking. It was probably the best thing I ever did. And I look at people letting go of these behaviors, right? We go to therapy because we want behavioral change. We can't have behavioral change if we keep doing the same thing over and over again. It's not letting us learn to manage and tolerate the uncomfortable feelings that are forcing us to act out. I love Eckhart Tolle's book, In New Earth, when he talks about the pain body. It's a tough read for a lot of people, but mm-hmm. That chapter is so great, right? It's like, what's activating you in a negative way that's causing you to do something over and over again that's not working for you? So we can call it addiction. We can call it, you know, denial. We can call it whatever you want to call it. And let's call it something so we can get help.
And recognize that it is what it is, whatever label you put on it.
That's right.
With someone who is addicted to porn, and, you know, certainly people have lots of different ways that they think about that. You know, well, I'm only on the computer once a week, but by golly, it's got to be at least once a week. Or the person who's on, you know, for hours and hours. With the person who's addicted to pornography, online pornography, do you have thoughts or concerns? Is there hope at the end of that tunnel?
Yes, there is. I've worked with a lot of porn addicts. And what I can see, other addiction, any other mood disorder, anything that's going on, you have to look at what's causing it, right? You have to look at what's causing it. And when you look at a lot of the people that I've met that have porn addiction, they started using pornography, you know, masturbation compulsively to release stress and energy. And then what happens is they become addicted to it, and then they need it, and then they think they need it, and then all of a sudden one day it's not working anymore. You know, I had I had an experience which I'll share with you on speaking with somebody who was in jail because of child pornography, and I have my own personal opinions around that. Here I am on, you know, a radio show. I have to be very mindful of what I'm saying. I don't want to judge people yet. That's a tough one for me. I think it's a tough one for anyone if we're honest, right?
I think
it's
you're
really
right.
Tough one.
Yeah, it is.
And so, having said that, here I'm sitting talking with this man, doing some interviewing because I was trying to understand more so I could help people more, because I'm seeing it more and more, and it keeps coming into sessions, right? So I have to address it. I can't just ignore it. It's all over the place. So I'm sitting here talking to this man. He tells me about what happened for him. And what happened for him is that he started watching erotica and then reached a level where his tolerance was so used to it that it wasn't working for him anymore. So then he started watching hardcore. Then he reached a tolerance. It wasn't working anymore. And I had this huge aha. I thought, wow, this man's giving me such a big gift, because it's kind of like, how does this person go from drinking on the weekends tequila shots to sticking a needle in their arm with heroin? It's their tolerance. They're looking for something more intense, something that they can have more, you know, response to. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. So with pornography, what people need to understand is that if you have a history of addiction, attachment disorder, a lot of anxiety, starting to watch porn is a way to sneak around or to release stress or try to do whatever it is you're doing, you're playing with fire. You're playing with fire because that's the beast that once it gets there, it's very hard to unleash. Can you unleash it? Yes, but it takes a very, it's a process. I mean, that's why some of the treatment centers that treat it do such a good job. You know, and we see it a lot with some of the women that come through our doors. You know, it's becoming more prevalent with women. You know, it's a tough one to overcome. You can overcome it if you're willing to let go of technology for a while. I mean, it's not easy. It's not like just staying out of the bars and not buying any alcohol at home and having an addiction that doesn't have nearly the shame attached to it.
And
sexual addiction has a lot of shame wrapped around it.
You know, one of the things that I notice anytime I do a program here on Mind Talk about sex addiction is, you know, the responses get very silent. You know, if it's a call-in program, the calls really drop off. People really are anxious or any number of things to even think about sex addiction, to even talk about it. You know, there may be an uncomfortable giggling, but that's kind of it. And, you know, when the broader society thinks about the porn addict, they think about a man. But you're bringing in an important point that women can also be addicted to pornography as well.
Well, yeah, we live in a very pornified culture. Pamela Paul, who writes for the New York Times, I think she still does, but years ago she wrote a great book called Pornified. And what she assessed in that book 10, 15 years ago, whenever it was written, has come true. I mean, the work that Patrick Carnes has done, you know, it's amazing to me how, you know, anybody that's still going to be listening to this show, to those of your listeners that haven't dropped off yet, I want them to hear this. This is so important. It's not about the sex. It's not about the porn. It's not about the alcohol. It's not about the food. It's not about the shopping, right?
Absolutely.
The question is, we want to get curious, what's it about? What's underneath all of that? That's what we need to do a much better job getting to. Because we can put all of the bottom lines and boundaries in place so the cows come home. But we'll break through those boundaries because we don't do well with a lot of restraints. So you got to get underneath it all and treat that underlying cause of why somebody's so uncomfortable with themselves that they have to check out when they can't manage and tolerate their feelings. Does that make sense to you?
It makes absolute sense. It speaks to so much of, in my opinion, what needs to go on in any sort of therapeutic environment, whether it's an intensive or long-term or whatever it is, you know, getting underneath the behavior on top so you understand what the purpose is, what you get from it and what you don't get from it. And also the fact that there can be hope, that you really can opt to make a change, although it may not be overnight.
That's right. You know, and if you have any clinicians that are listening, you know, there's like the Foundation Recovery Network has a behavioral healthcare conference. I mean, there's so many voices out there. There's so many minds coming together looking at how we can better serve that underlying cause and treat it. Like, how can we get there and how can we treat it, right? There's a lot of really positive things happening today with helping people understand more and more about some of these mood disorders, about some of these addictions. Like, how can we do a better job helping people?
And, how can we understand it in a less shaming, less blaming way, which is, I know, is very important to you.
Very important. And I think it starts with honoring everybody as an individual and not getting these simple templates. Like when I go in to do a talk at a treatment center, for example, and I see that they have a class called Healthy Relationships, and they have, like, handouts about these are all the characteristics that you need to have a healthy relationship, I want to throw up.
Hopefully you restrain yourself.
And anybody that knows me is getting a giggle, right? Because I don't, and I breathe, and I'm invitational, and I'm very professional, and I just get curious. I'm like, wow, it's so interesting to me that the expectation that this is going to apply to all the different types of people you have here is really interesting to me.
Which is a lovely way of saying, are you nuts? We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Lori Jean Glass, who is a relationship expert, and we're going to continue our conversation with getting off the crazy train. We'll be right back.
Okay. All right.
Lori Jean Glass, a relationship expert, and you come to this having had your own challenging experiences, as you said earlier in our conversation today. When you sought to find your own voice, was it challenging? Was it easy? How did you do that?
Well, it's very challenging. I mean, I was one of those people you were describing earlier in the show that couldn't look at it. It was too painful.
Mm.
So what happened for me, which is why I think I work well with those types of challenging cases, because what happened is that you fall down enough, you fall down one day and you can't get up. I mean, that's what they refer to as a bottom. And I'd already gotten sober off of alcohol, and I just couldn't manage and tolerate those feelings. So I started to seek help, and part of why I helped create the curriculum at Five Sisters and do a lot of speaking and educating is I couldn't really find the help I was finding was very fragmented. It was like different people were helping me, but nobody was talking the same language.
Interesting.
So I had to go in, and I started reading books. I started getting an understanding of what was going on. I started really understanding the impact of unresolved trauma. You know, I kind of like went into my own little think tank, and I was fortunate enough to be able to take the time, you know, to really, really take a look at what was really going on. And I had to identify the behavior because I knew it wasn't about my mother's death or my father's death or some of the other trauma, which, you know, I don't really need to get into my whole story. I just knew that when I would show up to be in relationship, if somebody didn't approve of me, it hurt. And if I was going to go through life hurting because I needed everybody to approve of me, then that type of codependency would keep me out of self. So I had to kind of go inward and go very deep and understand and identify the behavior and be an advocate in my own journey. You know, I had to start trusting myself first. You know, we have all this talk about learning to love yourself before you can love others. You almost have to trust yourself before you can really get the right help that you're going to know and be able to have discernment around what's working for you and what's not.
And even with that, it can be such a challenge. I mean, none of the things that we're talking about, you know, which could ultimately wind up on a T-shirt someplace because that's what this world does, but none of them are easy. None of them happen overnight. And none of them happen without intention.
none of what happened.
What we're talking about in terms of finding your voice, in terms of making choices, in terms of asking yourself what it is that you want to have happen differently in your life or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that either happens when you hit a bottom or it happens when you feel like you're done and you want something different. And sometimes it can happen because you're given the right invitation, you know? Seriously, like I think that there's a lot of people out there that are waiting for the right invitation by the right person with the right language. Like I think we sit back and we sometimes watch people and don't really know what to say.
Well, that's true.
Or don't think it's our business, and we don't have to wait till we hit bottom. I was talking about that the other day when I was somewhere doing a talk about, you know, why wait till the elevator gets to the basement? Like, we don't have to do that. We don't have to do it. Like, that's not a rule. It's not one of the Ten Commandments. We don't have to get that broken, you know?
Which a lot of people think is the case. They think it is one of the, they may think it's all 10 of the commandments.
That's right. I was going to say that, you know, when you want to prepare to have a shift in life, I think the first thing you have to do is identify your behavior and what it is you want to shift. And then you get the support for it. And then you observe yourself. Like, learning to be the observer of your own life is such a spiritual movement. Like, to be able to really observe yourself without judgment for a little while so you can start understanding why you're doing what you're doing, such a gift to give yourself, you know, because then you can identify and you can see where your pain body is getting activated, what's going on for you, you know, because then you can make a decision of what you want to do with it. But you can't make a decision of what you want to do until you know what it is that you need to do something about and be honest with yourself about that.
You know, I think that for so many women, more so than men, there's often the, and I'd like to hear what your thought is, but it seems to me there's often so much more shame, or maybe it's a different kind of shame, that attaches to women versus men when they're dealing with any number of addictions that we've talked about and others, any number of relationship patterns or styles. I mean, I think I hear more often from women than men, what was wrong with me? Why did I do that? And then going down that shame road, which ultimately gets in the way of leaving that shame road.
Well, I have a couple things to say to that. First, it's I understand what you're saying, and I do believe that women and men both very equally have that experience. I just think that men display it and get to it in a different avenue.
How so?
I think that oftentimes men are very, they can shut out their emotions. They internalize their emotions. They don't display their emotions as much. That's why we see it more with women, that it's in there with men. I think one of the most undertreated types of addictions in our society is the male love addict. And there's so many of them out there. There are so many of them out there. We get calls all the time at Five Sisters Ranch. Why don't you take men? Why don't you take men? Like I hear you, and I really do believe that the reason why we don't hear it as much from the men is because of how they don't speak about it. They think about it. They move it up out of their emotional being, and they just think about it, and then they start either obsessing or ruminating. Whereas women will feel about it, and then they'll get into their feet and just either get on crazy train right away, or they'll try to do something about it or control it or fix it or voice it. Or women have that ability to say it more than think it.
But it doesn't mean that
they're not having the same experience with shame inside of them.
Gotcha. And when you say male love addicts, you know, I think language is such an interesting thing, because when you say sex addict, we tend to think about men. And when we hear love addict, we tend to think about women. What's the difference between the two?
Well, love addiction is really when you trade sex for love. Oftentimes sex addicts, or someone will get diagnosed with sex addiction when they're really a sex and love addict. So it's really driven through their wanting and longing to be relational. It's just they've learned to be relational through sex.
Okay. And the sex addict
usually doesn't want to be relational. They just want to be able to get their high, if you will, off of just a sexual experience. But they don't want any kind of attachment with it whatsoever. Oftentimes people do use sex as a way. I meet so many young women that have been diagnosed with sex addiction that are trading sex for love. Or thinking that's the only way they can connect because they've learned to connect through sex.
And clearly that kind of driver is not a sex addiction. It's clearly a love addiction.
It's a sex and love addiction.
Okay.
Yeah, and again, that's why you want to go underneath it, right? You want to go underneath all that. Because when you look at the signs and characteristics of any kind of addictive relationship, you're going to see that, you know, that tendency to trade sexual activity for love or attachment. You know, oftentimes there's an existence of a secret double life, and one of those sides of the life is very driven sexually, you know. And then it comes up with the avoidant relationships, too. So again, it's like, it's not about the porn, it's not about the sex, it's not about the love, it's not about the work, it's not about the food. You want to start looking at what's underneath it. And what's underneath it is very similar. It's somebody with attachment disorder, with mood disorders, with, you know, that kind of woundedness, unresolved trauma that hasn't been resolved.
And you use the word woundedness, and I think that's important for all of us to remember that under those behaviors, many of which the larger society can look at with disdain, with judgment, that underneath those behaviors is often profound woundedness. It's not just this bad person doing these bad things or behaving in these mean and selfish ways. This is a real live human being who has sustained a significant amount of wounding him or herself.
That's right. That's right. And it's a survival pattern often for them.
Absolutely.
You know, like somebody, we have a lot of opinions around people that board crazy train from love addiction because they are crazy. I mean, when you're doing drive-bys all night long and you're calling 48 times in a row and you're breaking into somebody's computer and phone, you know, that's crazy behavior. And it's going on in most of our colleges on a regular basis, right? So we look at that and we think, oh, crazy. But yet then we see somebody that, you know, is restricting food and not eating. And it's like there's all this compassion that goes around them, right?
Gotcha.
And so I think we just have to, again, be mindful of not, you know, judging it so much and yet holding people accountable.
Well, because
right?
the person who's doing the drive-bys and on the phone and going through the emails, I mean, that seems to me that rises to the level of stalking at some point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's their addiction, right?
Right.
Yet underneath it all, what we're talking about, that woundedness, it's no different than the person that's sitting there that won't let themselves eat. Underneath all of that is a woundedness. They're restricting. They're not allowing themselves to eat for multiple reasons. And we're not really here to talk about food addiction and
right.
all of that today. But it's what's interesting is very similar because somebody that restricts food is very avoidant-like in relationships. Somebody that's doing drive-bys and calling 48 times in a row is very anxious-like in relationships. So when you go underneath it and you really look at making sure that that attachment style is redeveloped for them as a healthy adult, you can have behavioral change.
And, you know, what you just said that I think is so important is that you can have healthy behavioral change. How many people... probably both of us hear from who say, well, this is the way it's always been and it can't be any different. And in fact, it absolutely can be different.
Oh, people can and do change all the time. My gosh, look at so many people that we've seen. We've seen not just, from the media and from people that we might know because they might either be, in political office or a celebrity or whatever. But I mean, look around your families. Look at people that have changed that you know in your life. People change all the time.
And I think
people change all the time. And people with, I'm a perfect example of that. Like, you can change. If you really want to have a secure attachment with people and understand yourself better relationally, you can have that. And that's going to mean understanding yourself. Like, I don't do well at Five Sisters Ranch. One of the pieces of curriculum is what we call circle boundaries. And I know we don't have time to get into all that, nor would I be able to do it on a radio show. But what I can share with you is that it is a template to help people understand how they can vet relationships, how they can move in and out of relationships, like give permission people to put people in an outer circle that aren't safe for them relationally. How do you put somebody in your inner circle? Like what kind of characteristics do you need? Obviously, I need to make sure that my good friends and people in my inner circle are people that won't abandon me, people that can show up and have the tough conversation, even if they're uncomfortable. That's something, a quality I need to have somebody be very close to me in my life because of my abandonment wounds from my mother and my father at such a young age. So that's something about me, right? So I know that about me, so that's very helpful when I go out to choose people to be in more intimate relationships. So everybody has their own template that they can create for themselves so they can go out and have relational freedom. Because if you're choosing in a manner that's going to serve you based on who you are and where you've been, right? You can choose differently, therefore change relationally. Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. And it's such a hopeful reality that I think more and more people need to hear. You can choose. You can make a difference. You can change. You can live the life that you deserve to live.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Is there a website that listeners can check out if they choose?
Yeah, there's two of them. They can go to my direct website, which is lorijean.com, LORIJEAN.com. And they can also, if they're interested in looking at Five Sisters Ranch, they can go to fivesistersranch.com. And the five is spelled out, F-I-V-E, and the sisters is plural, S-I-S-T-E-R-S, and ranch, fivesistersranch.com.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Lorijean, for spending time with us today and sharing your expertise with us on subjects that affect actually all of us. Much of the time.
You're welcome.
Thank you
You're
so
welcome.
Much.
You're and, welcome. Thanks, Pamela.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. You can listen to this program and all Mind Talk programs on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment or consultation with a medical, mental health, or other professional. The managing producer is Jim Brown in 26 by 2 Communications. You are encouraged to send your questions or comments to me at myndtalk@aol.com. And again, for more information about Mind Talk, you can always go to mindtalk.org. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.